Welcome to Chicago Jazz Revealed. I'm Mike Jeffers. We are live at Katerina's. Chicago Jazz Revealed is produced by Chicago Jazz Magazine and WDCB. Tonight's show, of course, with the name Chicago Jazz Revealed, that obviously means that we're revealing Chicago jazz. And the purpose of the show is to create a relationship between you, the listener, the jazz listener, the jazz enthusiast, the jazz fan, with the local jazz musicians and people coming in and out of Chicago, whether it be local or national acts. Tonight, live at Katerina's here in Chicago, 1920 West Irving Park Road. And, of course, we do also welcome live studio audiences. We have some people filing in right now, and I'm sure it's going to get a little bit more crowded. There they are. They're starting to clap. Thank you. That is not fake clap. That is real applause. Thank you. So we're live here at Katerina's, and tonight we've got the great pianist, Chicagoland's very own, Tom Uhlner. Tom performs all over town. Tom performs all over town, has a weekly jam session at the Serbian Village, which I know we're going to discuss a little bit. And he's got several releases out. He performs with many of the vocalists and many different groups throughout Chicagoland. So we're going to find out where Tom's performing and his kind of concept on music and on jazz and how he's kept his career thriving and vibrant all these many years. And also, vocalist Abigail Rickards is here. Yes, she's performing live. So we're going to have a couple of tracks from Abigail, and then we're going to bring her up and interview her as well. But before we get to that, we're going to feature La Percolatore. Now, La Percolatore is a local gypsy jazz group from Chicago, and they are performing on the Chicago Jazz Festival September 1st. I believe it's September 1st from 4 until 5 p.m. at the Jazz Oasis. Nope, I'm sorry, August 31st. I knew I was going to get those dates wrong. August 31st from 4 o'clock till 5 o'clock at the Jazz Oasis right there in Millennium Park. The Jazz Oasis is the Chicago Jazz Magazine stage booth. So La Percolatore will be performing there. And they have a new release called Pop Manouche out on Chicago Sessions Records. And it is getting a lot of airplay throughout the city. I know WDCB here is performing and using it. But also, it is getting a lot of national airplay. So why don't we kick off Chicago Jazz Revealed with a track from La Percolatore called Bad Crazy Day here on WDCB, Chicago Jazz Revealed.
And they've disconnected the phone. It's a bad crazy day, cause you know that nothing's changed and you wanna dance in your bones. Well, I knew they were out to get me, cause they told me they were out to get me. When I saw it on the television, I bought a shotgun for protection. It's a bad crazy day, it's a lousy crying shame, just forgotten. Nothing left but the way it lands. Now far too away.
Well, we're back here at Chicago Jazz Reveal. That was Abigail Rickards and Tim Fitzgerald. We're going to hear more from them today on the show, and then also we're going to have Abigail sit down. We're going to talk to her. But before we do that, by the way, wasn't that great? Wasn't that great?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
So we're here with Tom Uhlner now. And Tom, Abigail just came into your jam session that you have on Mondays at the Serbian Village.
Yeah.
What's the address on that jam session?
3144 West Irving. It's down the street from here.
And you guys have that every Monday night? Yeah, it's been going on for how long?
Almost 3 years.
And
it's a lot of fun. A lot of fun. Abigail was featured a guest. We have a featured guest every week for the first set before we let people sit in. And Abigail was featured maybe 5 weeks ago or something, and she blew everyone away, and we had a great time that night.
Now, just since we're talking about the jam session at Serbian Village, what's the time on that? Is it 9 to 1?
It is 9 to 1.
Monday.
Every Monday. Sometimes we start about 9:15. It's kind of loose, and sometimes we end about 1:15, but officially 9 to 1, yes.
All right, so for all of our listeners that show up there at 9 o'clock, and if Tom does not get going until 9:15, don't expect him to get started before 9:15.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then they have a chance to have a libation and relax into the situation.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the jam session concept, because I know you've done different jam sessions throughout. And I want to talk to you a little bit about your background and stuff. But since we're talking about the jam session specifically, why do you love jam sessions? I mean, obviously, you get to meet a lot of people. You get to hear a lot of musicians. But, I mean, you've been doing this, and this is like one of the hottest jam sessions in town. I think you're filled to capacity most Monday nights.
Yes, it's been very successful.
What's your drive to have a jam session? How does it help musicians, I guess, too?
It helps to be a little crazy, but because it's a kind of a free-for-all. But, you know, it's just a good excuse to have some fun and to meet some – network, meet people. Some great musicians have been coming in, and a singer from Poland came in last night. He was really good. I don't remember his name, forgive me. And Scott Hesse came in last night, and the week before, the first time I ever heard him, he's a fine guitarist. So, and great singers come in. Abby comes in, and Gail Cole, Barlene Bardell, and it's just a nice situation. And people leave their egos at home. We just have a good time. It's really what it's all about.
Well,
what else am I going to do on a Monday night?
Right. Well, and I was going to say it's got to be fun for audience members, just even if they're not a musician. It's got to be fun.
Absolutely. That's the thing. You know, I always believe that jazz should be fun. It shouldn't be real strenuous. It's a loose thing, you know, and especially at a jam session, you know. I mean, you know, you want there to be quality music, but you don't want to, like, you know, beat it to death. Let's just have a good time and play some good tunes. Abby did, like, some great tunes that we all knew. We didn't have to, like, be reading music. You know, that's the thing, you know. And pick tunes that are fun vehicles for musicians to improvise on.
Mm-hmm.
Simple as that.
Well, you know, speaking of the jam sessions and speaking of having fun with jazz, I mean, that I think is the name of the game. And, you know, you've played with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of musicians. But, you know, how did you get your start? Now, you used to be in marketing, weren't you, or in advertising?
Well, I've been playing music since I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
When I was maybe 8 years old or something, my grandmother lived downstairs. She had a piano, and as soon as I could reach the keys, I started playing melodies to Christmas tunes. And so I've been playing since I was a kid. But, you know, I had a family. I was raising a family. and all of that. So I needed to make some enough money to support that. So for 20 years, I was I ended up being an advertising guy for an electronics company.
So that was your day job?
Yeah, for 20 years.
But you were still playing?
Yeah, I played on, you know, weekends and that kind of stuff. And I would even play some week nights and, like, get to bed at 2 and we have to wake up at, you know, 7 o'clock.
Sure, yeah.
And show up for work and, you know, and
be real productive, I'm sure.
Yeah, play the game and pretend real good.
Great.
But, no, it was... You know, and now I've been playing full-time for about 25 years, so that was a while ago when I had a day gig.
Okay, so you got into music. Now, what was some of the big gigs that you had that kind of propelled you to get out of the advertising scene and just say, you know what, I'm just going to do this for real?
Well, you know, I'm crazy, so, you know, to become a full-time jazz musician is, you know, it's like the guy who wins $10 million in the lottery. I'm going to play jazz until money runs out. But I you know, music is, and this music is me. It's who I am, and it's hard to do anything else, you know. But you know, one of the great experiences I had in my life was playing piano with Ira Sullivan.
We should talk a little bit about Ira, so the people that don't know who Ira is. Ira is probably the world's greatest multi-instrumentalist, don't
Absolutely.
You think?
Absolutely. He's, you know... Bill Witz, yes, you know, Bill Kleewitz.
Sure. He takes photos for Chicago Jazz Magazine.
Yes,
I'm well,
he is.
Well
and
aware
he,
of Bill Kleewitz.
And he's a fine musician
Great.
As well. But he always, when we talk about Ira, he says, oh, yeah, Ira, the world's greatest jazz musician, you know. But what I learned from Ira is that you better be ready to play any tune ever written in any key at any tempo. Mm-hmm. But one of my favorite Ira stories is we were playing in front of an audience, and he started playing some tune, a standard, but I just never heard this tune in my life. So and he sensed, you know, the deer in headlights look that I had, and he taught it to me in one chorus. He just kind of like leaned his horn towards me as he kept looking at the audience and played arpeggios. Now, this is a genius because not every saxophone player could do this. In this case, he was playing saxophone.
Mm-hmm.
Every arpeggio was a chord change. They're like, oh, 2-chord, 5-chord, 3-chord, 6-chord. By the second chorus I was in, I knew the tune by then, and everyone thought I was being real hip by laying out on the first chorus, like being it was some hip jazz thing, when in reality I didn't know the tune, but he taught it to me in one chorus, and that's a master musician. So you, when you play with people like that on that high of a level, you know, you just by osmosis you just gain this understanding, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
that almost brings us back to that jam session concept as well, because with the jam session, you know, beginner players can come in. I mean, they've got to know tunes and everything, but they can come in and they can play with somebody like you, where all of a sudden they probably wouldn't be normally playing with somebody like you at
Absolutely.
A gig.
I truly believe that if you play with high-level musicians, it will bring you to that place eventually. And one of the things with me is when these players come in, and, you know, sometimes someone will come, a guitarist came in who didn't know a lot of tunes, a lot of regular tunes, and I'm like, you call a tune. What tune do you want to play?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just make it work. You know, you make it work. And when he called a tune he knew, we all played it with him, or I wasn't maybe playing at the moment, but... It made it work, and that's, I believe in that, you know, and to encourage and to not isolate people. Let them feel like they're, you know, come on.
Right.
Bring them in.
Well, music is an inclusive art
form. It should be. It should be.
Speaking of high-level playing.
Yeah, right.
Your first release, It's All About Time.
Yes,
I like to think of it as It's All About Tom, but It's All About Time is the name of it, right?
Glad you met me, Mike. It was a great thing for you.
Features Dave Marr, Tim Davis, Art Davis,
yes.
Great Chicago players.
Yes.
And what year did this come out?
Boy, that must have been like 1994. 94, something like that.
94, 95, your first release. But this is the trio, and then you also have Art on some of the tunes,
Art
right?
Davis, who I love. Art is one of the most melodic and lyrical players, but just swings
His tail off,
thank you. Let's keep it clean.
That's right.
You know, he really is a marvelous player and just one of the greatest musicians I've ever had the pleasure of working with. And Dave Marr, who lives now in San Diego, has a beautiful sound and was a great bass player. And I really miss him. We do talk every now and then. And Dave, I'm glad
he
was part of this.
Well, Dave Marr and Tim Davis and yourself, that was a regular trio for a while.
For
you guys
many years.
A lot of steady gigs.
Many years, yeah. And Tim is just a phenomenal drummer. I just love his playing. And, he brings a lot to the table. And, you know, I'm fortunate. I get to work with great musicians. Kelly Sill, Larry Cohut, Dennis Carroll, and, you know, and those are just some bass players offhand, you know, and Phil Grateau helps. He's really the guy that runs the session with me, and I can't say enough about Phil's playing. He's just Mr. Taste. So whenever I do a gig with a singer and Phil is on drums and Jim Cox and myself, they call it the Dream Team. Maybe they're talking about those two guys, but Phil, if you're playing something, some Coltrane type stuff, Phil can rise to that occasion just as well, you know. So I'm fortunate to work with such great musicians, and there's so many great musicians in Chicago and great singers, and I get to work with so many of these people. It's just, I'm a lucky guy.
Well, why don't we hear a track from your CD, It's All About Time? And we're going to hear Donna Samba. This is an original that you wrote.
Yeah.
Is there any story behind it?
That's my younger sister. And she was getting married, and it originally was like a ballad I wrote for her wedding thing. And that was a long time ago. But then I thought it was much hipper as a samba, and so we recorded it.
All right, well, let's take a listen to Tom Muellner and the Tom Muellner Trio, Donna Samba, here on Chicago Jazz Revealed, 90.9 FM, WDCB. Thank you. support for WDCB and Chicago Jazz Revealed comes from the University of Chicago Presents, announcing its new jazz series, Jazz at the Logan, in the new Logan Center for the Arts. The season opens on October 25th with the Bad Plus and continues with Annette Cohen, Dick Hyman, Bill Charlap, and others. Subscription information at chicagopresents.u, chicago.edu. All right, we're back here at Chicago Jazz Revealed. I'm Mike Jeffers here on WDCB. We are live at Katerina's here in Chicago, 1920 West Irving Park Road. It's okay if anybody wants to clap. That would be fine. Yeah. See? Wasn't that a great... That was a great tune by Tom Muehlner and his trio, It's All About Time. That was Donna Samba. Mm-hmm. We're going to hear another tune from Tom in a little while, but... You know, we were talking on the break about all the different vocalists that you've worked with.
Yes.
And all of the different places that you've been able to work over the years. I know what comes to mind is obviously your gigs with Arlene Bardell at the Coke Door for many years. How many years were you there?
About 4 years.
4 years. And that's when she was there four nights a week or five nights a week,
right?
Yeah,
she was there about 6 years, yeah. And, oh, she's a terrific, terrific singer.
But they don't have those kinds of gigs anymore, do they? Not there specifically, but I mean, how odd is it for somebody to have a gig 4 to 5 nights a week?
Yeah,
right?
That's true. Yeah, it seems like those days are gone, and how unfortunate, you know.
Well, with the Coke Door, let's just talk specifically about that since you were there for so long. The Coke Door, for those of you that don't know, the Coke Door is a famous club, the downstairs of the Drake that's been there since, 1920?
Yeah,
just after Prohibition.
Right.
They opened the Coke Door, and they have a piano in there, and they feature vocalists and piano players most of the time. And Tom had the great fortune of playing there, not only with Arlene Bardell, but you were there with several different vocalists. I think Colleen McNabb was one of them.
Yes, for a couple of years with Colleen. She's a great singer. She worked with Joey DeFrancesco for a while, too.
You know, talk about that story. Because you were telling me that when Joey would come into town, sometimes he would just come in and pop into town, and if you couldn't make the gig at the Coke Door, you would actually sub the gig to Joey and wouldn't tell anybody, and people would walk in and see Joey sitting there at the piano.
That's true. Joey did sub for me once, but we tried to keep it a secret because, I was working with Colleen, and it was at a place called Philander's in Oak Park.
Oh, Philander's, okay.
Boy, it's so sad to see these kind of places go. But, that was a nice place to work. Anyway, and Joey's an old friend of mine, and he came by the Drake one night when I was working with Colleen, and then the two of them became close friends, and, you know, so that's how that started. But
so you just called up Joey, like the number one B3 organ player in the world, and said, I'm Tom Muehlner. I need a sub. Are you open?
Well, you know, I couldn't do the gig one night. And he said, hey, man, I'll do the gig for you, you know. But luckily, I'm on two recordings with Joey. And on one of them, we actually do play together on a couple of tunes, and that's Sonny G's recording. Sonny's a great singer and a great guy. And on the other one is Colleen's recording, but on that one we actually did not play together. Colleen and I did a couple tracks, just the two of us, but then she did other stuff with Joey and Steve Gadd and some phenomenal musicians. So my name's on the same album with Steve Gadd and Joey, which is pretty cool for me.
Well, I can only imagine the crowd sitting there in Philander's watching him walk in. And sit down and start playing, and half of them didn't know who he was anyway.
Yeah, so more than half. But so that's kind of the good thing about it.
You know? And then you also play. Of course, you play here at Katerina's a lot.
Yes, I love this place, and I love Katerina. She supports the arts, well over 10 years, and I've been playing here well over 10 years, and it's always a great pleasure. I've worked here with many great singers. I'll be here actually with Gail Kolb on Friday. And Gail Kolb's a wonderful singer. And I've worked here with Arlene Bardell and Spider Saloff. And I've worked here with my own groups, you know, the Dracula Quartet.
I was just going to ask you, you know, Tom Muehlner says he got out of advertising, but he comes up with some great marketing ideas. So right around Halloween... I get the listings that it's the Tom Muehlner Dracula Quartet.
Yes.
And is it because you guys love that the Dracula movie, right?
Yeah. Well, I have like-minded friends.
That happen to be really good musicians.
Yes, yeah. Bill Overton, wonderful saxophone player. Actually, John Campbell, my good friend, he lives in L.A., great, great jazz pianist and vibraphone. He was actually at the session about 3-4 weeks ago visiting.
Mm-hmm.
And he played vibes, and he played piano, and he played bass, and he played drums, and he's great on all of those instruments.
Mm-hmm.
If there was, if someone would have come in with a violin, he probably would have played that too. But but anyway, John and I started this thing called a Bella Fest, and because we like to get together and just hang out and have a couple of beers and watch these old Bela Lugosi movies, you know, and even some of the campier ones from the 50s that were not, you know, not too well scripted, but they're fun, you know. So anyway, and there's several other musicians who kind of are into this. Eric Schneider's come over, and
you guys just hang out at your house?
Yeah, and just, you know, and Bill Overton and all these different people. Kelly Sill's been
there.
What
time is this usually happening, like 5 in the morning or something?
Yeah, it starts about 4 in the morning.
Yeah.
No, it's usually on a Sunday afternoon or something.
Oh, okay.
Anyway,
okay.
So we extended that into the Dracula Quartet, and, you know. So it's,
I mean, you've done a couple performances of the Dracula Quartet.
Yes, we have. Yeah, and it's fun. You know, it's a lot of fun. And we do, like, we kind of tie it in with a Halloween theme, and we do tunes like "Ghost of a Chance" and "Haunted Heart," and, you know, any excuse to play jazz. You know, you can, you know, it's just fun. You know, I try to have fun, and you know, play some great music, and you know, I take it serious, but still, let's have some fun.
Mm-hmm. You know, speaking of the Dracula Fest, you used to, and I'm not sure if you still do it, but do you still do the Bill Evans tribute at the Green Mill?
We haven't
done
that.
You used to, right?
We used to. We haven't done that in a few years. It's a lot of work, to be honest, and
yeah.
I haven't been aggressive about it. But Bill Evans is, what can I say? I learned, I would say, most of the building blocks of theory and harmony in pianistically, I learned from Bill Evans. I got to know him before he died, and actually hung out with him a couple of times. Here in Chicago, yeah. He was playing at Rick's Cafe Americana. I was in my 20s. That was a long time ago. I kept, you know, hey, I want to listen. And finally...
Would he even teach people, by the way, since we're talking about... I mean, I can't imagine he was taking even casual students.
Warren Bernhardt used to go over to his pad in Fort Lee, New Jersey, and take some lessons or something, I heard. But I don't know. Yeah, Bill was more of a guy who liked to hang out, you know, or once in a while. And I never really did take the lesson with him, but I did meet him at his hotel, and we hung out for an afternoon. We went to Rose Records. And this is in the days when LPs were happening, before CDs. And we went into Rose Records, which was one of the things we did that day, and I found all of these Bill Evans records. And I saw
So you're looking through Bill Evans records with Bill Evans?
Well, yeah, he's standing next to me. And I found this one from, I wish I could remember the name of the record. It's early one. He looks real collegiate, you know, kind of nerdy.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, Bill had a beard and, you know, long hair, and I held the album stuck in his face and says, "Is that you, Bill?" And he says, "Oh, that's my mother's favorite picture of me." And he was a wonderful cat and an absolute genius. I mean, not the genius word people throw around nonchalantly. I'm talking about bona fide, brilliant genius, you know, and a beautiful person, and I certainly learned a lot from Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, mm-hmm. Coltrane, and other great pianists, but Bill certainly was an important part of my life.
Well, I'm just looking over your CD. Your it's all about time, and you have a Bill Evans tune on here, Song
That's
for Helen.
That's true, yeah, right.
So yeah. Why don't we take a listen to Song for Helen?
Sure.
And then we'll come back and we'll hear a little bit more about what you have coming up.
Okay.
And we'll have a little bit more time with Tom Muehlner here on Chicago Jazz Revealed, 90.9 FM WDCB and ChicagoJazz.com. All right, we're back here at Chicago Jazz Revealed, and we've got a little bit more time with Tom Muehlner. Tom, I wanted to talk to you, since we were talking about vocalists, and vocalists specifically in town, since you work with so many vocalists, how important is it for vocalists to have their charts together? Only because I know that you write charts.
That's true.
And that's something that you're kind of an expert at doing, and it just seems to me like it would be, you know, common sense that a vocalist would have their charts together and be able to walk in and play. But I think a lot of them are not as prepared as they should be, shall we say.
Right. Well, I've worked with some singers who have these disastrous-looking things that I, thank God I know those tunes, and I can kind of like, okay, I see what they want me to do, but I'll do what I know is right. But, you know, when you're playing with a group and the bass player doesn't know it, you're kind of forced to play those changes so it sounds right. But generally, you know, there's singers I work with, like the great Spider Saloff. She, a lot of times, you know, there's just no charts. You know, she just has a list of tunes and she know and her keys, and we kind of will do it by the seat of our pants. And I do like that too. But I think it's always a good idea to have charts. Because, you know, let's face it, musicians are working and, you know, with different people. And so sometimes you have to kind of throw a group together for a last-minute gig. So it's good to just have charts so that everyone's on the same page and, you know. But again, I don't want to overdo charts. I think it's good to do stuff by the seat of your pants. And, you know, if you've got your stuff together, you should know a fair amount of standard tunes, you know.
Well, and since you're running the jam session too, you know, I think a lot of vocalists, especially the ones starting out, obviously the seasoned ones, such as Abigail Rickards, who's going to be performing here very shortly, she understands, she knows her keys, she knows her arrangements, and she can go with the flow, just like a lot of, you know, a lot of seasoned vocalists. But I think that, especially since you're running the jam session and you probably even teach or work with some up-and-coming vocalists.
Sure, yeah, I do vocal coaching. You know, I'm not a singer per se, but I know what the melody should be.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times singers will sing something in the key that they think they sing it in, and I'll say, you know, you might want to drop that down a step. And, you know, it will bring out the richer part of their voice or you know, whatever. So in terms of, I guess that's what I call vocal coaching. And then I do teach theory and harmony to, you know, I have one student who's got two master's degrees in classical music. And, but he can't play the blues, you know. So, so, you know, jazz is a feeling and blues is a feeling. And, you know, that's a part of it, you know, and certainly it's good to have classical training and it helps a lot, but you know, you kind of need a composite of those two things.
Well, and that's one of the things, classical musicians, myself being a musician, and when I was in school,
we played many gigs together.
I know, you and I have played many a room.
That's right, and we just played the Taste of Chicago with the great Laurie Shelley.
That's right, Laurie Shelley and Arlene,
the great Arlene Bardot.
We're going to hear a song coming up from her next. But you know, with the classical side of things, it's really difficult, isn't it? If they've only been taught classical, to kind of get away from that sheet music and actually improvise. And that's kind of what you're talking about, right? I mean, you're working with people to do that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you know, one time I did some kind of clinic with Mike Smith, the alto saxophonist, great player. And part of this clinic, he said, "Hey, Tom, can I sit at the piano?" And I'm like, "Yeah, sure." Sat at the piano, had a saxophone, and these young saxophone players were there. And he says, "I don't really play piano, but I kind of know the chord changes." And so he picked the tune Stella by Starlight in B-flat, standard key. And he played that first chord. And he hit the sustain pedal so that the chord would ring out. And he played notes and arpeggios and scales that fit.
Mm-hmm.
And he one chord at a time, if you break down the song, one chord change at a time. And you do that, you know. And these young saxophone players, I think, maybe learn something, because sometimes you'll hear one of these young guys or women playing a device that doesn't fit with the chord changes, you know. And that was an interesting lesson I learned from that, you know, when Mike said that, you know, he showed them that, you know. So I don't know why I got into this, but, you know.
I don't know, but it was interesting.
Yeah, that's right.
That's good. Well, all right, why don't we jump back over to vocalists, and speaking of Arlene Bardell, what we played with at the Taste of Chicago, she's got a new release out that you just happened to be on, and I'm sure you helped her with some arrangements. And,
yes.
And probably tempos and all and tune selections and all of that other good stuff.
Although, I'll tell you, I've learned a lot from working with people like her, because she knows a ton of tunes. And, you know, you try to know a lot of tunes, but, you know, every singer you work with might have a tune or two like, oh, I don't really know that one. And or they do the verse, and you learn these verses, and you learn to play in other keys.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, in fact, sometimes it's an occupational hazard. I don't remember the standard keys sometimes. You know, if I'm playing with a saxophone player who plays everything in the standard keys, I forget sometimes.
It's because you're dealing with singers. You work with so many singers.
Yeah.
Sure.
So, and it's good to play in different keys. It's a another color, another dimension, brings out another dimension of the song you're playing.
Sure.
When you're playing in another key. Of course, then every now and then a singer will call something in the key of B.
Is that bad? I'm a drummer, so it probably doesn't bother me all that much.
Well, you know what? It's good. It keeps you on your toes, and it's good in that sense. But you're not going to groove as good in that key as you would in B flat or something, you know.
All right, now I understand.
Yes.
See, you just taught me something. Well, why don't we take a listen? Thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure. And Mike, you do a great job of promoting jazz in Chicago, and we all love you and appreciate it.
Well, thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks, Tom. Thank you. Well, why don't we take a listen? So this is off of Arlene Bardell's latest release, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow? And we're going to hear the tune I'll Take Romance with Arlene Bardell on vocals, Tom Muehlner on piano, and a cast of other musicians.
Yeah, terrific players.
So let's take a listen here on Chicago Jazz Revealed. Wow, that was fantastic.
Well,
Abigail Rickards, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, wasn't that great? Now, before we start talking about your new CD, all of the gigs you're playing around town, all the great things you're doing with your new CD, and the whole background of your new CD, the first thing I want to find out about is, where did you find Tim Fitzgerald?
He was in a gutter somewhere.
Oh, is that
but
right?
He had a hat, and he was trying to get some tips. No, I actually, when I moved here 2 years ago, Tim Fitzgerald was playing a steady gig at Andy's.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the night I moved here, I remember, I went to see Kimberly Gordon. She was doing Sunday nights at the Green Mill.
The Mill, yeah.
And Kyle Ashe was subbing for who's Andy Brown was usually on that
gig. Okay.
So I made friends with Kyle. He was my first friend here. And he told me, you should come hear this singer I'm playing with next week. And so I'm trying to meet everybody in town that I can. Singer was Sarah Marie Young.
Mm-hmm.
So Sarah says, I play with this other guitar player on Tuesdays at Andy's. So I met Tim very indirectly through many, many people. But pretty very shortly after.
So he busted in on Tim's steady gig.
Totally.
Took it over, and the rest is history. Well, you guys sound great.
I remember how nervous he looked when Sarah said, you should ask her to sit in. He's like, oh, yeah, maybe at the very end of the night. That's so true.
The truth comes out here on Chicago Jazz Revealed. It's just been revealed, Tim. Sorry.
It's that look that a lot of instrumentalists get when you say you're a singer.
Oh, yeah. I know.
I wish
I'm
you could have the visual
I'm
right
a drummer,
now.
It's the, and I get that look. I give that look, and I'm not even playing chord changes back there.
Totally true. And guitar, you know what, Tim should have been a little more sympathetic because guitar players get that just as much as singers do.
That's true.
Everyone
that's
sings true. And plays guitar.
Yeah, you're right. Singer-songwriter.
That's exactly it. It's a tough
can
business.
Can I sit in? You know, actually, since we're talking about this, I actually played a wedding, and this friend of the groom, and the guy was in a room.
Oh, that's always a recipe for disaster.
Well, and he was a guy that was like in a famous rock band, right? And he wants to sing My Funny Valentine. Ooh. And now I'm playing drums. I don't know.
I'm imagining like Bono singing My Funny Valentine now.
Well, he was probably about, you know, 27, 28, had the whole hair thing. So, I mean, he looked like... Oh, man, this guy's awesome. Except to the jazz trio that was sitting there going, this guy's not going to be awesome. He played one chord. My Funny Valentine, one chord.
Was it at least a minor chord?
It was like D minor or something.
Oh, well, that's a...
And the bass player was sitting there shaking his head like, I don't understand what's going on. And everybody went nuts.
Love it.
See, all these chord changes, they're just overrated. They're just totally overrated.
Mike, are we doing the wrong thing? Have we been going in the wrong direction for all these years?
I think so. Cancel the chord changes. Just get really hip-looking hair.
Oh, God, I need
and
that.
And that's it.
All right. Our hair looks good. If only you could see out there in the internet world.
That's right.
Or radio world.
Radio world. Radio world.
We look fantastic right now. Right, everybody? Yeah. Mike Jeffers has great hair.
I think your hair is a little bit better than my hair. You've got that cool looking comb that looks like a
thank
microphone.
Thank you. Yeah, that was an infomercial device my mother bought me.
Mr. Microphone and Hair Comb.
It is. It's very retro.
Okay, since we got sidetracked.
Which I do tend to do.
So do I. So I went right down the rail with you. Why don't we come back, and after you busted in on Tim's gig.
Okay, after I busted in on Tim's.
You must have come from somewhere, and I believe it was from New York.
It was from New York City, yeah.
So how did you find yourself moving to Chicago from New York?
I had heard about Tim Fitzgerald, and I thought, I need to live near him.
And now you're moving back.
The legend.
She met Tim,
it's your favorite show now.
She met Tim Fitzgerald, and now she's moving back.
No, my husband is he's getting his PhD from Northwestern.
Okay.
So we had made the decision to move. We knew he was going to go to a PhD program. So mm-hmm. when it came to choosing which one, it was per my request that we moved to Chicago because I knew how great the music scene was and what a great city it was. And I've never been happier about a decision we make. We made it. It's just
well,
a great place.
Well, you were fairly established in New York. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
You were playing a lot of gigs. You
yep.
were playing with a lot of people and doing a lot of things.
I
was. It had to be kind of a really tough decision to say, you know, I'm going to just stop doing this here and go do this somewhere else.
You know, it wasn't. And I'll tell you why. Because to just live in New York and sustain oneself is so difficult. And I think after 8 years, I loved it. I loved the musicians. I loved the venues. I was exhausted,
yeah.
and I needed something fresh and a way to see what a different scene is like. And this isn't getting broadcast in New York, right? No, just
no,
between us.
Sure,
just between us
no.
Chicagoans. I actually like the scene here a lot better.
Yeah.
It's a lot more welcoming. There's more work for what I do. You know, traditional.
Well, when you say you're a little like stressed out when you're in New York, or not stressed out, but you know, it's just
it's exhausting.
Exhausting. What do you mean by that? Is it just it's constant?
It's overpopulated, intense. It's very expensive. You know, there's so many musicians there that I think that a lot of club owners can take advantage of that and not pay you and
yeah.
not book you or book you. And I mean, I had gigs where I paid to play.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it was that. And I have once, you know, I just went back this past week and I did my CD release event at Birdland, and it was fantastic. Like, I can say hands down that Johnny Valenti, who owns Birdland, is top-notch in the world for club owners. So it's not across the board. You know,
right.
every place has their positives and their negatives, and Birdland happens to be a club that supports their artists and promotes their events, and really, actually, he gets a real kick out of promoting people who... He had me playing there 5 years ago, people who hadn't... Who he just liked to hear.
Oh, really?
Yeah, who hadn't had an established name or anything like that. So he's great.
Yeah.
You know, but there are other places. Like, I'd say that the established clubs that we know about, I've always had a good experience with.
Mm-hmm.
It's the the restaurant scene and the, you know, the things you try to do to make a living that were much tougher than they are here.
Sure. So getting out of there, you moved to Chicago.
I did.
And I remember, actually, you and I talked, I think, the first 6 months you got into
town. It was like
town.
The first month I saw
you
out.
Yeah.
And I said, let's have lunch.
That's right.
And
That's
our hair looked great.
And you
great
came all the way down to Bridgeport.
I did.
Our hair always looked fantastic.
I
think this is a whole different show.
I think
show.
Somebody stopped and asked us, who does your hair?
So, yeah, I did. I came here and I made the decision. I had so many odd jobs in New York to make ends meet, mm-hmm. that I made the decision that I'm going to go full force into this, and I'm going to meet as many musicians as I can, as many people active in the music community and jazz and promoting jazz, and I did that full force the first few months I lived here.
Well, and then right off the bat, I remember you started getting gigs and you started performing places.
Yeah.
And obviously you enjoy the experience.
I do.
Now, your husband, Dan Healy,
yes.
who also writes for Chicago Jazz Magazine, on top of...
He's an academic.
I know, he is.
We shun him.
But he's also a very good sax player. He's a good sax player, too,
he is,
right?
Yeah.
Let's not shun him that much.
I shun him. He should be here any second, actually. He can fight these charges.
He might not want to be shunned. He might turn around and leave. But Dan's in town, and you're in town.
Mm-hmm.
And so you started playing different gigs, hitting all the different steady places. And you decided to put a new CD together.
You know, that project, thematically, had sort of been in the works. The gentleman who played piano on it and arranged it was a good friend of mine in New York, and we had been talking about a project for a while. So about a month after I moved here, he's also Jane Monheit's accompanist. So
okay.
we had gone to Notre Dame and driven out there to mm-hmm. see them play, and I missed him so much. And we were like, what about this project? Because we actually had recorded another album that we canned. It was a duo album, and it didn't work out.
Oh, really?
And so we always had it on the back burner that we were going to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And he just said, make it happen. And Jane overheard that, and she said, I would like to be a part of this, too.
Really?
So that's how she sings on the album. She produced it.
Wow. Yeah. Now, let's talk a little bit about that. So this is called Every Little Star.
It is.
And the concept behind Every Little Star is, why don't you let us know?
Well, I decided early on that I don't have the money to produce an album in the fashion that I wanted to, as most of us don't. And I had noticed a lot of crowdfunding things mm-hmm. going on. And I had mixed feelings about crowdfunding going in. I think that part of me thinks it's a great idea for people to contribute. I have a lot of friends outside the music community who have jobs that provide them with the income to be able to sponsor things like this, and family members. And then, part of me sees how people look down on it and are like, you're just begging and it's not. So there was a mixed emotion about, and I understood both sides of it. So I decided, how can I do a crowdfunding project and be comfortable with it myself?
Mm-hmm.
So
and by crowdfunding...
I used Indiegogo. Yeah, crowdfunding is when you set up an internet campaign to raise a certain amount of money for your project. You make a video about the goals of the project. People can pledge. They get certain rewards, advanced copies of CDs, tickets to shows, and then you can...
And these are nonprofit companies that or for-profit companies that set these up. So actually people are not donating directly to you, but they're directing
it's like a PayPal donation to Indiegogo. And or Kickstarter or whoever.
Right.
There are a million of them out there now. And so when I was in New York, I was working for a nonprofit organization called Art Strides, which is a branch of another company that I was working for called Music Together, which is a family music class. And Art Strides was bringing those family music classes into areas where kids were in financial need or mm-hmm. Kids who had developmental disabilities. So we were doing all sorts of things with those classes that they couldn't ordinarily get.
Okay.
So I love this nonprofit, so I thought, well, I'd feel okay about raising this money if I don't make a profit on it. So I teamed up with this group, Art Strides, and all of the profits, all the proceeds of the album have been going to them directly.
Oh, so that's interesting. So I think a lot of times, especially with Chicago Jazz Magazine, we get a lot of information. A lot of people want us to promote their Kickstarter mm-hmm. program. And I feel the same way that you feel, that it feels weird for us to be doing something like that if all this is basically then they're going to make the CD and then they're going to make all the money off of it.
Yeah, and there's so much money to be made from jazz CDs.
Well, there's got to be at least $20 or $30.
I know.
I mean,
it's like... But it's like that clip in Home Alone with John Candy, where he's like, if we put out a poke album, we sold about 200 copies. And I thought, that's awesome. If I could sell 200 copies.
Well, I have a friend of mine in L.A. who recorded this CD and everything, and he always jokes every time he's on a radio interview that he happens to have 999 more copies in his car. Yeah. So if anybody would like one.
You should see my house. Three albums later.
Well, it's good insulation, though.
Ooh.
In the winter?
I actually bought a bench, a hollow bench, and that's the CD bench. That's the promo bench. There's posters in there, and you can't lift that bench for anything. I wish it were a little lighter.
Well, going back to the CD, I left
but
a little.
But I digress.
Right. Going back to the CD, so all of the money you're actually donating back to a nonprofit.
Yeah, you know, the CD just came out. We haven't done much, but I've been able to donate $800 to Arts
Trust. That's great.
So they're happy. They're psyched. They were at the event that I did last Thursday. So I ended up raising $15,800
wow.
to make this album. And I ended up putting in probably about $4,000 of my own, just because albums
yeah.
always end up more expensive than you think they're going to be.
Sure, sure.
And profits are going out, and it's getting good reviews. And
well, yeah, and I mean, you're getting radio play. I think you've got a couple of a review coming up in Jazz Times. You mentioned,
yeah, yeah.
And I know that we're going to have something in Chicago Jazz Magazine, and I know that
you better.
It's not nice to threaten the host.
I'll wait till the commercial break.
That's right.
Okay.
Please, then we don't have to edit it out. But with that CD now, what do you do since it's, you know, all the proceeds are going back to a nonprofit? I mean, are you pushing it as hard as you would push like a regular CD?
Harder. Because I feel an obligation now to mm-hmm. somebody other than myself. And, you know, the nice thing about the crowd surfing thing is the crowdfunding.
That was at Lollapalooza
awesome.
A couple weeks ago. That was Lollapalooza.
Is that you can raise a lot of money, which I did. The drawback is that most of the rewards that people got were advanced copies of the CDs, so that drastically
okay.
reduced my market
sure.
for selling CDs. So I've hired a publicist. I'm getting some good reviews. I'm doing other things and, you know, live performances and trying to sell them there and
mm-hmm.
keeping track, and they're getting it all.
That's great. Well, why don't we have you and Tim go back up and do another tune here? And I know that for the last tune of the evening, I think you're going to persuade Mr. Tom Muehlner to come back
I
up and play
so,
a tune
if he wants to.
with you as well.
Tom,
but
do you know any tunes?
Just a couple.
Maybe we know one of the same tunes.
Well, I hope you brought charts. Did you hear him talk about charts?
I don't bring charts. I'm a singer.
But why don't
no,
we start with you
charts.
And Tim?
Okay.
And why don't you guys play a tune and
we
come
will.
Back? Okay, we're back here at Chicago Jazz Revealed. Wow, Abigail, that was unbelievable.
Well, thank you, Mike. Thanks for having us here tonight.
And you know, after the phrasing that I just heard on that last tune, kind of brings me back to how you got your start and, you know, your training. Now, you got your master's degree.
I did.
In music?
I did.
Is
ultimately.
It music performance?
It's jazz performance.
Jazz from yeah. what school?
I did my undergrad at UMass Amherst and my master's degree at William Patterson in New Jersey.
Oh, okay. Who'd you study with there?
William Patterson. Nancy Morano was the voice teacher.
Okay.
There.
And, you know, I noticed, I mean, listening to so many different vocalists, there's such a difference in each vocalist's phrasing, even though it's the same words, it's the same everything. How do you go about developing that?
You know, when I moved to New York, a bunch of people had recommended that I study with a great singer-pianist named Dina DeRose.
Mm-hmm.
And Dina actually lives in Austria now, but we were in New York at the same time, and she was the most amazing mentor I ever had, and that was a big thing. She came at it from an angle where she was a pianist who she got carpal tunnel and needed surgery and then learned to sing, whereas I'm trying to do the opposite right now. I'm doing a lot of solo gigs, so
right.
hopefully I'll be amping up my piano a little bit, but sorry about that. We talked a lot about phrasing, and her philosophy was if you're going to say it a certain way, then sing it that way. So we did a lot of speaking the lyrics, writing the lyrics out in various ways too, like a poem, like a letter, underlining words that were most important. So
mm-hmm.
it took a long time, and with each new tune that I learn, I read the lyrics like a book and decide, how would I say this? And it's going to be different. I always tell my students, it's going to be different for everybody. What a word that I might emphasize, if you're singing the same song, might be mm-hmm. a totally different word than you would emphasize.
So that's interesting. So you actually wrote out the lyrics, read it like a book, or read it like a poem.
All the time.
Because I know I've been to different clinics and different jazz camps, and I've heard the vocal coaches talk about, you know, especially with instrumentalists, they should learn the tune, like sing it, play it exactly like how Sinatra's playing it, or Ella played it, or sang it, I should say.
But I think that learning the melody is imperative, learning the actual melody.
Before you start changing it?
Yes. Yeah. And in fact, I think it's important to sing it before you change it, no matter where you're performing it. Like, the melody is an integral part of the song, and people abandon that right off the bat. So I try, at least personally, the first chorus to state the melody as it is. The point of the phrasing is going to change the rhythm and not the notes. So I think that we're less bound to a tune rhythmically because the phrasing is what we have in a uniform way as jazz musicians, instrumentalists, and vocalists. Everyone talks about phrasing. It's a huge part of what we do. Nobody's going to phrase like Sinatra. Nobody's going to phrase like Sarah Vaughan. You might have shades of it. You know, I hear Kimberly Gordon sometimes. I close my eyes, and she sounds just like Ella Fitzgerald. Just like it sometimes. You know, Rose Colella, I hear Blossom Dearie when I hear her. So you hear these reminders of other artists that are wonderful and that are influences. But when it comes down to it, you're going to come up with your own phrasing that's going to be personal. And if it's not, then people aren't going to buy it. They're not going to believe in it.
You know, also talking about the lyric, too. I mean, I think a lot of vocalists just, okay, yeah, here's the lyric. I'm singing the lyric. This is what it says here on the page. But I don't think they actually really get in depth into what the meaning of that lyric is.
Well, and it's so powerful that we have that. That's something we have that instrumentalists don't have. So I always laugh a little bit when instrumentalists get a little bit squeamish about playing with a singer, because singers are always going to connect to the general public because we have words. We have language that everybody understands. So it's top. It's absolute top of the list of things to worry about.
But, I mean, just the lyric itself, you know, somebody, actually Stephanie Browning, who's a vocalist that I work with a lot, she is really analyzes the lyric.
Yeah.
And, like, sometimes, like, I mean, she'll plan out sets because this lyric is this and this lyric's that. Now, I know the tune, but I've never gotten that far into it. And, I mean, it's amazing when you go back and you really research how these people wrote the tunes.
Yeah.
Because it's really meaningful. And, I mean, you know, we might just throw a tune away and say, oh, yeah, okay, fine, let's just play Just Friends or let's play this because we play it all the time.
Yeah, definitely.
But when you really get into, if I didn't have a melody, I didn't have any chord changes or anything, I'm just reading these lyrics, I'd be like, whoa.
Yeah, some of them. You know, I did a show a couple of months ago that was a tribute to Richard Rodgers.
Okay.
And so the show spanned chronologically from his work with Lorenz Hart to his work with Oscar Hammerstein. And I didn't realize, I mean, I guess I should have realized from the tunes, but if you look at Lorenz Hart as a lyricist from the beginning of his career until when he drank himself to death, it got darker and darker and darker, the types of tunes he wrote. You know, something like My Romance was a very early tune. Something like My Funny Valentine was a later tune.
Yeah, yeah. Well, see, that's really interesting. I think that, well, you tell me if I'm wrong, I would imagine that...
You're never wrong.
You can be on the show anytime you want. My new guest host.
I'll talk to your wife about that. You're never wrong.
Yeah, she won't agree with you, trust me. Not after tonight. Anyways, my car broke down, and that's where she's at right now.
Okay.
So
she's a nice wife.
She's very nice. Yeah, I couldn't believe it. There's my pause so that we can edit that out for WDCB. Don't say anything. Okay, we're back.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Oh, well, it's a pleasure. But I think that with the lyric, along with the phrasing, along with, you know, obviously knowing tempos and everything. But when you're programming a set, when you're doing something live, like say a live performance, whether it's with a quartet, you probably are planning different tunes than when you're just doing like a solo duo thing like what you're doing right now.
Definitely.
And does the lyric and does the phrasing and does the overall feel of the entire set, you know, how much does each one weigh when you're planning out a set?
They all weigh in. I think the instrumentation, as you mentioned, a duo, will affect the phrasing of the lyric, too. So, you know, when I knew I was doing these tunes with Tim, it's obviously going to be a much more intimate environment as a duo. So I'm going to sing it differently than if five guys are there with me. So it all goes into who am I playing with, what type of tunes, what's the room like, and even, you know, we were talking about the album and the money going to a kid's charity. It actually has a theme, the album, and the title is Every Little Star, like we mm-hmm. said. Because it was a kid's charity, I chose jazz standards that represent for the love of a child, not a romantic love, not a sadness or a loss. And that was a big challenge for me, piecing together 12 yeah. songs that were all personally represented my love for my nieces and my nephews and the kids I worked with. So that was all lyrics, mm-hmm. all every bit of it. And in fact, when Michael was doing the arranging for it, he called me and he said, I don't know where you're going with this. What are you thinking about with this? And we would talk through a tune. Like I picked Singing in the Rain, and all the photos on the album have us with umbrellas because the title was supposed to be something about singing in the rain. And then we changed it so we just look like a bunch of goobers with umbrellas. When he asked me, you know, why did you choose this song and what are you thinking about it, I said, well, this is actually a little melancholy for me because it was really nostalgic. It was my favorite movie when I was a kid. And he said, well, it's, you know, how is it melancholy? And I said, well, I think of it as a very internalized song. When I watch the movie, he's singing and dancing, but he's alone in the streets. And when somebody walks by, he gets a little embarrassed. And so I think it's something you're saying to yourself. So it represented my childhood, which was why I picked it for the album. But, you know, lyrically and everything, I think it's like a little party and for you, just for you.
Well, see, that makes a lot of sense. What's going to be interesting is because I think we're going to talk Mr. Tom Muehlner into coming back up.
Is he still here?
He's still here. He's relaxing over there in the
he's
in
had
the
a
audience.
Few. He's ready to play. With me, I mean. Yeah.
Well, here's what's going to be an interesting contrast, and especially for our listeners, too. Now, you've played three tunes with Tim on guitar and vocal, and we're going to close out the show with a song by Abigail Rickards and Tom Muehlner, and Tommy's going to play piano. But before we get to that, what are some of your steady gigs? Where can people find you? More details at...
Well, I'm going to actually be the Jazz Oasis with Chicago Jazz Magazine at the end of the month. I'll be there on Saturday at 2 p.m., so that's my
Saturday,
big thing.
Saturday, August 31st.
Yep, that I have coming up that I'm trying to promote and get people out to the Jazz Fest.
And I should tell everybody that is going to be at the Millennium Park because the Jazz Festival this year is in Millennium Park.
Right?
They shifted it over, and that Jazz Oasis is going to be set up near the Bean. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to have a really cool backdrop. And it's in the afternoon, and you're going to be performing from 2 to 3
yep.
at the Jazz Oasis. And, of course, there's more information at chicagojazz.com.
Yep.
But with some of your other steady gigs, and if they want to find out more information about your Every Little Star release, they can get more information at...
My website, abigailrickards.com, or you can just go directly to CD Baby and check out Every Little Star. You can listen to samples and pick it up there, and all the proceeds go to Arts Drive. So,
well, that's great.
Mike, I can't thank you enough for having me here, and I'm honored to get to play with Tom, who's wonderful, and Tim, who's great, too.
Well, we're looking forward to hearing you, and thank you.